Now, I understand the premise that some regions have less cases than others, and you look at New York City and it's dense, so we have to be, you know, more defensive than another market that doesn't have that density of illness nor that density of population. I get it. There's differences between the two. But what the hell does that have to do with how many feet we stand apart? If you stand 6 feet apart in New York City, where it's densely populated and we have a great concentration of the virus, in theory, if you wear a mask and you wear gloves and you wash your hands and you stand 6 feet away, you're supposed to be okay. So if I stand 6 feet away in New York with a mask and gloves and I stand 6 feet away in Dubuque, Iowa, with a glove and a mask, what the hell is the damn difference?
I don't want to share someone else's thoughts. I want to create my own original thoughts. I want to create my own original solutions. I want to look at situations and come up with my own phrasing, my own words, and do it my way.
This is the John Taffer Podcast.
Shut it down!
Hello, everybody. John Taffer here with my podcast, and I don't even know what fucking day it is anymore. I think it's day 56 of my lockdown here in Las Vegas, and you know, it's an interesting week. States are starting to open, which is a cool thing. And I was looking at the different regulations between the different states because, of course, I've been working hard trying to support my industry and doing as many news shows and send whatever messages I can to support the industry. But, you know, what's interesting is, for example, in the state of Indiana, I believe you can have 10 customers for every 500 square feet. In Texas, you can have 25% capacity. In other states, it's 50% capacity. In some states, you can't have people sit at the bar. In other states, you can. In some states, you can't have customers standing. In other states, you can. In some states, you can't open a dining room, but in others, you can. So the differences from state to state are really sort of crazy, and I wonder what you guys think about that. You know, I really thought when this would open that there would be a standard that we could all follow. I remember years ago, I opened up a restaurant in Tempe, Arizona. And when we opened that restaurant in Tempe, Arizona, not long after we had opened, they illegalized smoking in Tempe. But the towns next door still had it. So it wasn't a global or a statewide program. It was an extremely local program that zeroed in on one community. As an end result, that community got gutted after that simple smoking rule because all people had to do was go two blocks away. And two blocks away, they could engage. So when we do policies and rules like this, imagine if you lived on a state border. And on one side of the street, they're allowed to have 50% of the people, and the restaurant has some energy, and a bar has some energy, and things are going pretty good. And on the other side of the street, you're only allowed to have 25%. And the place is freaking dead, and it's not working. So what's happening, I'm concerned, is there's going to be competitive disadvantages and advantages in this setup. And the rules made by one governor could be cutting the legs off our entire industry as compared to the legs of another governor who might be acting a little more favorably with regard to industry interests. And I'm concerned about this. And, you know, I wonder what the science really is to having 20, if people are wearing masks, and we're staying 5 to 6 feet apart from each other, and we're focused on keeping those distances. Is there really a difference between 25 and 50%? And does 25% create too much space between us? And are we sacrificing space for money? And that raises the biggest dilemma that we've had. You know, so I'm concerned. You know, I'm not the youngest guy in the world, and I'm concerned. I don't want to get this damn thing. So I've been staying home, and people come into my house have to wear a mask, and, you know, I'm very cautious, and so is my wife, Nicole, and most of the friends that I have are looking at this very seriously, and we're being extremely cautious, and we're taking the steps that we need to take to protect ourselves. Now, there's other people I have. I have some people who work for me who actually had COVID-19, and they took their antibody test, and son of a gun, they got their antibodies, and you know, that's almost like a get-out-of-jail-free card. Now they want to go out. They want to party. They want to have fun. They want to see their friends. They want to travel. They want to go do things. And what's happening is, as a society, where does the value lie? And I know we're all struggling with this. I know that people are demonstrating, and they're fighting, and they're saying the government is overstepping our freedoms right now, and I get that. On the other hand, industries are saying, like my industry, the restaurant industry, are saying, this is going to kill us. We're going to lose possibly 40% of the bars and restaurants in America over this. Think of the families that impacts, not only owners, families. Think of the debt that creates. Think about the broken dreams that creates. Now, when you think about 40% of the bars and restaurants in America, off the top of my head, there's about 200,000 to 225,000 independent bars and restaurants in America, something along that kind of a number. Can you imagine if we lose 40% of those? Call it 100,000 for conversation's sake. So we lose 100,000 bars and restaurants. Again, just for conversation's sake, I'm not sure that's the correct number. But imagine the impact that that has on 100,000 families, 100,000 locations, 100,000 pieces of real estate, 100,000 employers. How about this? 100,000 refrigerators that farmers can't fill, food manufacturers can't fill, distributors can't fill. 100,000 bars that have no liquor bottles on the back of them. 100,000 bars that don't buy napkins anymore. Don't use silverware anymore. Don't use plates anymore. Don't use dishwashing chemicals anymore. 100,000 bars not using equipment anymore. Imagine the impact of that on our society. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should risk lives to facilitate straight commerce in a black and white statement. I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that there's a balance. And I'm suggesting that we need to get our arms around what that balance is on a nationwide basis. Now, I understand the premise that some regions have less cases than others, and you look at New York City and it's dense, so we have to be, you know, more defensive than another market that doesn't have that density of illness nor that density of population. I get it. There's differences between the two. But what the hell does that have to do with how many feet we stand apart? If you stand 6 feet apart in New York City, where it's densely populated and we have a great concentration of the virus, in theory, if you wear a mask and you wear gloves and you wash your hands and you stand 6 feet away, you're supposed to be okay. So if I stand 6 feet away in New York with a mask and gloves and I stand 6 feet away in Dubuque, Iowa, with a glove and a mask, what the hell is the damn difference? So I reject that premise in a sense. I reject the premise that it changes city to city. Yes, it changes foot by foot. I don't want to stand 2 feet from you, 3 feet, four or five. I want to stand 6 or 8 or 10 feet from you. But I can stand 10 feet from you in New York, and I can stand 10 feet from you in Dubuque, Iowa. So the issue to me is about distance, not location. And if we don't get this right, we're going to kill the restaurant industry. We're going to destroy it. And these places will never reopen again. So we have to understand, and we as individuals, I believe, have to have the responsibility to stay distant from each other, not only to protect ourselves, but to protect each other. And if we as a society agree to maintain these distance and mask and these policies, then these restaurants can open again and these businesses can open again with the right spacing and procedures in place to protect us and protect the business. And I worry that people are not thinking that way. So 6 feet is 6 feet and 8 feet is 8 feet, whether you're in frickin' New York City or whether you're in the middle of a farm in Iowa. There is no difference. So if the science is distance, then let's play the game of distance. Let's do it right. Let's put national standards in place so we know nationally what needs to be done so we as an industry can react to those national standards. Everybody has the same playing field. We're socially responsible to each other, and we move forward. Doesn't that make sense to everyone? It certainly makes sense to me. So today I wanted to bring a real restaurant guru in. Dan Rowe is the president of FranSmart. And if you're curious, you can go to fransmart.com. FranSmart is one of the largest, most successful restaurant franchising companies in the world. You've heard of Five Guys. Well, Dan's company is the one that grew Five Guys, Halal Guys, Qdoba. So FranSmart has grown so many restaurant companies that are now household brands. They understand the business. They understand trends. And Dan is on the National Restaurant Association board. So I wanted to really have a deep discussion on where we're going as an industry, what's happening out there, and what are the policies that we need to put in place to be successful? Because what we're doing now isn't working. It's not fair to own a restaurant in one place and be a disadvantage over owning it in another place when at the end of the day, it comes down to the same damn 6 feet. So I want to talk about this a little with Dan. I want to talk about how our industry moves forward and what we can do to get past not only sustaining this period right now, but how we can get back to really reopening and building our business. When I come back, I'll be with Dan.
Don't shut down this podcast. John Taffer will be right back.
Dan, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You know, you and I have known each other a long time, actually. I guess we must have met, 15 years ago or so?
Yeah, about 15 years ago in Florida.
Yeah, a long time ago. And you know, I've watched you take your company, FranSmart, to the forefront. I mean, you are a true leader in this industry, in a franchise space, and as a board member of the National Restaurant Association. And what was exciting to me to have you on the show is you touch so many different kinds of brands. You know, you deal with franchises in the Italian space. You have Halal Guys that you deal with. You know, you got Five Guys to go national. So you've touched so many brands that are household brands to us. And you work on the National Restaurant Association board. So I was really eager to have you here to talk about what's going on. And
all right, thanks.
And first of all, what do you think of the current situation when you look at these states that are 25%, 50% occupancy, no standing at the bar, no standing in the room? And you know this business well, Dan. You know it from fast food and casual dining. Can we sustain this?
You can't sustain it. So it's the best hope is that that's going to be a transition to sort of ramping back up into some normalcy, but it won't. To 25% won't last forever.
Yeah, it certainly can't. We can't run that way. You know, I've been looking at friends who've been successful, who have really changed the way they're marketing by selling family meals to go and deconstructing meals and doing all these very unique kind of marketing things. What do you think are the most important things that brands need to do now in the restaurant space and operators need to do now in this market? When you take a look at marketing and communications, where do you see that going?
I think the most important thing that they need to do is they need to focus on building the trust with their customers and getting customers to feel safe about coming back into their restaurant. Customers need to feel smart using a brand. So they need to feel smart and they need to feel safe that it's actually going to be that it's going to be a good experience. But I think that's the big thing that people have to focus on right now.
You know, I've struggled with this whole premise of sustaining versus opening. And I've thought to myself, okay, I'm going to open with a 25% occupancy level and I'm going to try to sustain my business. I keep my employees working. That's certainly a good thing, right? I get to keep my crew intact so I don't lose my cooks and I don't lose all my staff who's trained and hopefully loves my brand. So I try to sustain myself during this. So I don't have the in-house volume. I don't have the delivery volume yet. I don't have the pickup volume yet, but I'm just spending more money every week. And what I worry about is that we as an industry sustain ourselves for so long in this configuration that we run out of the resources when it's time to really come back to the marketplace. And
right.
I've been advising a number of operating friends of mine, maybe we should wait. Maybe we shouldn't yet open. Maybe we should wait a month or two, let the marketplace build some trust. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree. I think that you want to definitely time reopening with volume. I mean, you cannot open a brand new restaurant. Not only are these guys financially on the margin, but they're tired. They're fatigued right now. And so if you open up and you finally get back to, you know, you finally get reopened, you're going to do 25% of sales. Like, it's just death by 1,000 cuts. It's just not going to last.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
And then, you know, I'm concerned about inventory. And as we come back online, so many of us have spent so much money sustaining during this period of time that now we're going to open. I got to fill my refrigerator, Dan. My food is bad. My beer kegs need to be replaced. I mean, I got to rotate stock through. It isn't cheap to reopen. So what I worry about is, and I see a lot of restaurants, they're stumbling to reopen. They only have one menu item. They don't have the dollars to really create a whole food inventory, go out a full menu. We're stumbling through this I'm going to put you in a corner now. When you look at the industry, what percentage would you guess doesn't come out of this?
Two thirds. I think you're going to see a third of the restaurants that just never reopen.
Right. I feel the same. I say it's a third to 40%. So we sort of agree on that number pretty much.
Yeah.
So considering the pandemic and considering that, you know, there will be a vaccine at some point, Dan, right? And life will start to normalize, whether that's 10 months from now or 10 weeks from now is a separate issue. When you look at our industry post-pandemic, once people are comfortable to go out again and stuff, do you think our industry changing permanently from this? Does dining in restaurants disappear? I mean, where do you think we go as an industry after this?
Well, one thing I think, I don't think dine-in is going to go away. I don't think it's going to go away. I think that's going to be the part that builds back slower, right? Because of the spacing and all that kind of stuff. But you've got a lot of restaurants that have a meaningful amount of off-premise sales now, right? So you've got, like I just saw, Cheesecake, right? Cheesecake's numbers, their stores average about $10 million a unit. They're now annualizing at $4 million a year in off-premise. I mean, that's a huge percentage. I saw Texas Steakhouse, somebody posted yesterday that their off-premise sales were some 500 and something percent up. And so these concepts now have to take that business really, really seriously. And I think that's not going away. I think that I think you're going to find that pervasive across all the demographic and sociographics is people are going to be using more delivery and third party, you know, the carry out and all of that. I think the off-premise business is here to stay, and you have to take that business really serious, because if you don't do a good job at that, that's going to affect the guest experience of your brand as much as anything else.
Yeah. And the way you package, the way you separate sauces today, the utensils that you provide, there needs to be an attention to detail to make a successful. You know, it's funny. I was consulting to a beer company today. I won't mention which one. And we were having a whole strategy session with a large beer brand, a household name. And we were talking about the fact that this company used to have promotions that would run from the beer cooler to the table. And that's what they focused on. Now it has to run to home. So merchandising has to carry to home. Merchandising on websites becomes more important. All of these elements become really, really important. You know, I've always felt that when we go through crises like this, and 9/11 was sort of the last one, Dan, that people sort of, and I'm going to use a dated term to explain what I'm talking about, but people cocoon. Remember when we had that term cocooning many years ago? And the premise of cocooning was when you go through an experience like this that sort of shatters our existence to some degree, that we go back to the things that we trust. You know, we go back to brands that make us feel comfortable, that are trustworthy to us, even products that are trustworthy to us, places that are trustworthy to us. We like familiarity when these things kind of happen. And I see that as a real change. I see neighborhood operations. You know, dare I say, I know you and I are working on Taffer's Tavern together, so I don't mean this as a marketing plug, but I do see taverns. I see more of these public houses, you know, more social environments with great food in them, because I think the food I can get delivered at home with high quality now, to come in, there's got to be something experiential that matters, right?
Right. Yeah, I agree.
So music becomes more important. Lighting becomes more important. Seating becomes more important. Flow becomes more important. All of these things become really much more important. When you look at the National Restaurant Association work that you guys are doing, Dan, what's the priority now for the association and the industry? I know we've been focused on employees a lot over these past few weeks, and we've raised millions of dollars with Guy Fieri's program and a number of other NRA programs. What are the priorities now for the industry as far as government and NRA work is concerned?
Yeah, so the work of the National Restaurant Association is really two buckets. And one bucket is advocacy and protection of the restaurant business. And it's, you know, the people that are with the politicians, and they're trying to, you know, make COVID, make the PPP as strong as you can, and getting that funds out. The thing you saw with Guy Fieri, $21 million right now of employee relief. So, you know, that's been tremendously helpful. And then the other bucket with the National Restaurant Association is all about sort of how do restaurants thrive? How does the restaurant business thrive? And so you've got this big collection of the best practices and the best known ways to do everything from, you know, group buying to, you know, e-health, and you've got ServSafe. It's like ServSafe is the gold standard in testing and certification for restaurant employees, which, by the way, the Restaurant Association has been giving away free classes for the last couple of months. So, but there's a lot, but it's really about trying to protect the restaurant business. They want to protect it both on the legislative side and then also on the business side and make this a very profitable business. If a business like this isn't profitable, people won't keep investing in it.
And you know, people often don't understand that they're not in the industry. Margins are tight in our industry. We're not walking away with 50 cents on a dollar. I mean, nothing like that is happening. Real estate costs are very high for good locations. The build out is three times what a retail store would be, right? To build out a restaurant with kitchens and all of that today. So it's a difficult business, and it's a business that typically has to provide a payback over a year period of time or so. And, you know, at this type of a revenue level, nobody's going to invest in new restaurants. But there's a flip side to this, Dan. And you and I were talking about this the other day. In the next few months, some of the greatest locations in America might become available. Is that true?
I think so. You're going to have, so you think about, to me, I see that you're about to have a big supply and demand imbalance. The supply and demand is going to flip 180 degrees. So you're going to have, it's been really tough to find employees, right? The last several years, that's been the bane of the restaurant industry. Well, they're expecting 10% unemployment. So it's about to be easier to find better employees for the restaurant business. Finding location has been tough. That's about to change. You know, you're going to have all these conversion opportunities. So the most expensive part about building a restaurant is really the stuff customers never see, is the mechanical, electrical, plumbing, hoods, zoning a restaurant zoning a piece of property to be a restaurant in the first place. And with a conversion, it's an opportunity for somebody to go after an A-plus location, take over a tired, dead, irrelevant concept, and then reskin it into something that's interesting. So to go from one concept to another concept, in this case, you're really talking branding, cosmetics, training your employees better, really focusing on the guest experience. It has nothing to do with all that expense. And so I think where, you know, the restaurant business used to have sort of 20, 30% ROI, you're going to see the industry is going to provide 50 to 100, maybe 200% ROI. If you pick the right spot and you're careful about rebuilding that into a new space, and then you actually, you know, you're talking about, you got to execute. You got to execute differently now.
You know, it's almost like the forest fire, Dan. And a couple of weeks later, you see the little green buds coming up from the ground. Right. And it's all renewing itself in that kind of a way. You know, I don't self-promote so heavily on this podcast, but you know, you are, FranSmart is our partner in Taffer's Tavern. You know, it's interesting. When I created Taffer's Tavern 2 years ago, it was because we couldn't get a labor pool. Right. So I couldn't find people. Payroll, of course, with minimum wages were going up very, very much, affecting our industry hugely. And the labor pool was so small that the only kind of employees we could find were new Americans that didn't necessarily speak the language so well. So I couldn't find people. The people I could find didn't speak the language very well, and I had to pay them more than I ever had to pay them before. So I created Taffer's Tavern as a concept that would use robotic cooking, very high technology ovens and cooking systems, and sous vide products so there'd be no raw protein in a restaurant. And my whole premise was I could reduce kitchen labor by 50% with systems like this. I could not need a hood, not need fryers, et cetera. So I could lower equipment costs. I could lower label costs. And I was reacting to the marketplace. I had to reduce the labor in a kitchen because I couldn't get labor for the kitchen. So I was trying to solve the problems of our industry. So what I wound up with, and when I put Taffer's Tavern together, and people might not know this story, I worked on this concept, went to test kitchens, worked hard for a year and said, okay, I got to find a great franchise partner. So I went out and signed with FranSmart, and I'm telling everybody this inside story. And FranSmart coordinates the marketing and the sales of franchises. And of course, my company coordinates the operating of it. So when we put it together, we inherently had all these sanitation practices. We didn't have the hood. We didn't have the raw protein. We didn't have the amount of people. It wasn't touched by human hands, right? The kitchen was more sanitary in its design. The equipment layout was different. Son of a gun, when we were finished, we wound up with the perfect post-COVID-19 kitchen. And it's an amazing thing when we look at the process that Taffer's Tavern has been through over this year. So we started with the premise of all labor management and training, reducing training needs. And we wound up with a concept now that I think is the perfect post-COVID-19 concept. Our sanitation practices are second to none. And I'm not doing this for the purpose of plugging Taffer's Tavern. I'm talking about the future. And I'm talking about how it happens to be me, but a concept was created that went into the next generation of food service, focusing on sous vide, no raw product, special cooking techniques, reduced labor, really high quality in a consistent basis. And that vision of excellence works pre-COVID-19 and post COVID-19. And that's interesting. So when I put all this together, Dan, do you think the kitchen of the future looks more like an operating room or a kitchen?
Probably a combination, but the way I describe it, this is sort of the Wayne Gretzky skate to where the puck's going to be, not where the puck was, approach to the restaurant business. Like, you did this a couple years ago before COVID. Really figure out, it's like nobody did anything new in casual dining or in the tavern business in the last decade. And, you know, you're somebody with a real soul. Like, you can create a concept that has a real soul and a real personality and a great drink program and an amazing food program. But it's on the business needs, which is, how do you do more volume in less square feet? How do you do more volume with a lower build out cost? Do more volume with fewer employees and have above average food, right? And so that's the genius with this sous vide cooking. This sous vide cooking is put together by chefs. This food is spot on. And they create it in a way that makes it easy for your staff at the restaurants to execute 100% all the time. Regardless of the volume of the restaurant, it's always going to be perfect. And it's always going to taste like it's supposed to. And it's always going to be safe, right? So we were talking about this safety stuff a year ago, where I'm like, okay, well, you know, we got to still, you know, this food is good on the, this is safe and this is trusty. And it's like, and you were right. Like, especially with COVID, it's like, oh my God, that's the first thing that matters right now.
Yeah. So we wound up with the concept of the future. And for those of us who don't know, we launched it a few months ago. We signed a bunch of deals and it was a hugely successful launch, and Dan is doing it with us. But, you know, I think that this is where restaurants are going. And I believe that the future of restaurants is technology more than chefs. Would you agree?
I do, 100%.
So where are the growth sectors now in the industry? I know Halal Guys is doing extremely well in that sector. What do you see as the exciting opportunities now in the industry?
The exciting opportunity for me. So with Halal Guys, like, we're growing, you know, the fastest growing Middle Eastern brand in the world, right? There's a billion Muslims and there's no brands. There's not retail brands. Most Americans can't name actors or, you know, musicians or whatever that are Muslims. This is the fastest growing brand, but we're Indians and there's no Indian concepts that are out there. So that's part of it. The bigger opportunity is to go into established, mature, big, pervasive markets with something that's new, right? And that's sort of what we're doing with you. It's like, nobody's done anything national new in the casual dining or tavern business. And it's a humongous opportunity. So I think that's where some of these specialty niche concepts could get to hundreds of units. A really good tavern casual dining concept could get to thousands of units.
So here we are. I'm cornering you, buddy, and I got this on tape. How many units do you think we take Taffer's Tavern to? What's your guess?
I think you're talking at least 1,000 locations.
Yeah. Wow. Pretty exciting. So to think that I've been working on this for 2 years, partnered up with Dan, whose Cracker Jack sales team put it together, went through all the test kitchen work, and people don't know how long it takes to do something like this, Dan, from the test kitchen work to the test bar work, to speccing the equipment, doing the systems, the procedures, the plate up, the software, the accounting, the design, the signage, the branding package, and everything that we've worked on to make this happen. It's an exciting time. Do you see this kind of growth in fast food going forward?
I think you're going to see some concepts that can get back up to 1,000 units. It's going to be something new in chicken. You're not going to see it anytime soon. You're not going to see it in chicken anytime soon. You'll see it in, you're not going to see it in burgers anytime soon, but I think that you will see fast QSR concepts that can get to those numbers. Yeah. But, you know, 1,000 units, there's just not a lot of concepts where there's room for 1,000 of them. There's some good ideas that can go into a market and it's the neat thing in that market. But, you know, the concept like this is something you could go after the 40 or 50 biggest media markets in North America. And you okay?
Yep. Good.
Oh, but I was saying you could go after the 40 or 50 biggest media markets in North America and go to Maine in each one of those areas, and they don't have anything like this. So it's not even like we're going to go and try and get market share from a bunch of people that are already doing this. this is a brand new way of doing it. And I think people are going to be excited to see it. And I think it's going to be hard to compete with.
Yeah, I think so too. So when you go forward and you've built an incredible career launching God knows how many brands, and you probably have, 12, 15 brands now that you're involved in at any given time. What is your message for people in our industry? If you could leave us
focus on
What is it, Dan? How do we go forward? How do we recover from this? Where do you see our opportunities?
I mean, I keep defaulting back to this is the restaurant business or this is the franchise business, and you have to figure out how to make restaurants profitable. Like, restaurants have to be profitable enough. Restaurants have to be profitable enough that the owners want to take that money and reinvest in more profitable restaurants. It's the ultimate way to get a compounded return. And so I see so many times, you know, you look at all these celebrity chefs, like big celebrity chefs. Like Jamie Oliver last year closed 22 of 25 restaurants. That was not COVID. That was not a pandemic. Right. That was bad business. And
Todd
even
English
some
too
of America,
similar
Todd, I mean, you got some of the biggest guys that are on network television and the Food Network every single day that have closed more restaurants than they still have open. And that had nothing to do with COVID. That had everything to do with they just don't understand the business side of the business. So why is that important? Well, it's important because if you don't have a restaurant, if you're opening a restaurant and it's not profitable, you're not going to keep investing in it. And the only way that you're going to keep customers wanting to come back is just that. They have to want to come back. And you've got to, you know, your most important customers are your employees, and you've got to treat them well, and you got to train them, and you got to take care of them. And if you're feeling a pinch, you don't want to do that. You know, one of the first things that you do, and it's a mistake, is you start to cut labor and you start to really turn the clamp down on your team. And it's a downward spiral. So my message to everybody is you have to focus on the profitability of the unit, right? And so that you want to keep feeding it, you want to keep growing your team, and you want to keep you've got to focus on the customers. Like, the customers vote with their wallets, and, you know, they have to want to come back to your restaurant. And so you've got to focus on the guest experience, and you got to focus on the profitability. And that's, you know, that's really my message to everybody. And I see it going wrong all the time. And I'm just constantly having the same conversation about getting it back to those two focuses.
So circling that around, when we lose 25 or 50% of our capacity, then all of this economic modeling falls apart. So as a society, we have to implement safe practices. We got to wear masks. We got to get this thing leveled out. We've got to get past this so these industries can start again. You know, I want to remind people that the restaurant industry is the largest employer in our country other than the federal government. We do not want our restaurants to go away. You know, if these restaurants don't fill their refrigerators, that impacts food manufacturers, food distributors, farmers. It goes right down the supply chain. So this is so important to us all. I did an interview today on MSNBC, and on the show they showed that 70% of people don't trust restaurants yet. 78% don't. So we as an industry need to build that trust, certainly, but consumers need to step up. We don't want to see these businesses go away. So as capacity grows, we have a chance to be successful again, but we can't lose our relationship with our customers, Dan, and that's what scares me during this time. I might not be able to build revenue right now, but I can still build brand equity. I can still communicate with my customers. I can still have a relationship with them through delivery, curbside, and other means. That's the challenge now, to stay relevant. So when this ends, I have the relevancy from which to build my business.
I think if you're talking about 25% of sales, I think there's going to be a spectrum where you're going to see half the spectrum that's significantly above that because they've been sales, and they're going to fare better. You're going to see some of the people that really suffer. There's people who have the right to still do 50% of their dining, whatever. Nobody's coming back. This little town I live in, Old Town Alexandria, strip where all the restaurants are called King Street. We walk it every night just to get out of the house. We walk it every night, and there's some restaurants that are busy right now, busy with carry out, busy with curbside. There's a lot of other restaurants that don't have a single customer in it. And I think that really, like, when things start going back, it's not going to be even that there's going to be 50% sales or 25% sales. I still think that you're going to get that across the spectrum. But yeah, the operators who want to thrive and make money, that's the other reason the restaurant association, we have a very big campaign right now going, $25 million campaign to speed up this cycle, right? To sort of speed up it's the restaurant revival going to take to get things back to normal. I mean, in North America, the restaurant sales are almost $1 trillion. It's over $900 billion. And it's like, we need to get that wheel turning. And so there's a big campaign going right now with some of the biggest chains in the industry, the big distributors, the biggest delivery companies, and the online ordering companies are all pitching in to this thing. Those campaign dollars are targeted for marketing, but it's also targeted at Capitol Hill. It's going to be targeted both sides to get this back. But I look too, John. I mean, I look, if you're, you know, you think about it, there's some real opportunities here. You know, some real opportunities here. If you're talking about a third of the restaurants that are never going to open, whether it's 30 or 40%, you've still got 100% of the people who live in any one particular trading area with now a third less people competing for those customers.
That's a huge shift.
A third less people competing for those employees, right? So it's, I think is sad as this is right now, this, and I've been through the dot-com bust. You remember the dot-com bust? Sure. And then right on the heels was 9/11, right? And then you had the whole economic meltdown of 2007, 8, 9. Like, I've been through, this is nothing, I mean, because this is different for a whole host of reasons. But from a business perspective, those were definitely some resets. But I think in this mess, I think if you can last and you can really start focusing on growing after this storm, I think you can make a fortune.
I think so too. You know, I think at times like this, great marketers bubble to the top, right? Great promoters create energy and bubble to the top, and great operators bubble to the top as well. And that's what I think we're going to see in these next few months. And there's a little bit of excitement in that premise, I think, to see what is coming next. And you know, I want to be a part of it, but I just want to say thanks, buddy. It was a pleasure to have you here. And you know, talk about the industry. You have a great vision going forward, Dan. And if anybody wants to learn more about your company, where can they go find you?
Fransmart.com. Just come to Fransmart.com.
That's Fransmart, Fransmart.com. And when you go to Fransmart.com, right there in the top, close to the, you're going to see Taffer's Tavern, won't you?
You sure will. Yeah, you sure will. No, we're honored to be working with you. We're looking forward to this. And I appreciate this. I've been following all of the social, all the news segments that you're doing. And I think that you're 100% right with the way that we're going to come out of this and where people need to focus their energy.
Yeah. Hope so, buddy. I look forward to that next up. And I look forward to talking when there's some success when this ends to talk about.
Don't shut down this podcast. John Taffer will be right back.
Well, that was an interesting talk with Dan, and I appreciate him coming. And you know, this is a time where we have to take a deep breath. We have to start building trust as business people in the consumer marketplace. The restaurant industry, the retail industry, the location-based entertainment industry, whether it's a bowling center, or a sports arena, a baseball field, it doesn't matter. We all now have to work to build trust. If we as industries build trust, consumers will come. That's the way this is going to work. So we have to have the guidelines to build trust. Customers need to know that we're following those guidelines to build trust. We need to know what the hell those guidelines are, and the customers need to know what the hell those guidelines are so they can be comfortable we're doing them, and we can be comfortable that we know what to do. So this is what has to happen, and I call it standards. And standards is a term of measurement of performance. And a standard should be qualifiable. This is what I want you to do. Quantifiable. This is what I want you to do it. And verifiable. I'm going to make sure you do. And that's sort of where we're at as a society right now. We need the standards to protect ourselves. And when we get those standards, we can go forward. So I'm looking forward to seeing the decisions that are made these next couple of weeks as we narrow down on what these policies and procedures are going to be. And as the states take a deep breath and start moving towards normalization. I'll talk to you next week. Take care.
Subscribe to the John Taffer Podcast right now for more episodes every Thursday.